The time is noon. Stay tuned now for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and the Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Maven Chronicles and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. In 1961, Seminary Co-op Bookstore was founded by 17 book lovers who invested $10 each. Now, this consumer-owned bookstore is three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue carries about 200,000 titles and is widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a neighborhood bookstore carrying a wide selection of general interest titles in a unique space perfect for browsing. And the Newberry Library's bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in genealogy, cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more in a beautiful landmark setting. The Seminary Co-op Bookstore's passion and experience have appealed to readers throughout the world. All their branches offer 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, as well as special author events. Visit the Seminary Co-op Bookstores today. Call 800-777-1456, toll-free, or look up semcoop.com. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Anne Lamott. And we go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here's Victoria Lautman.
My goodness, what a crowd. Thank you so much, and welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. That is I. We are so glad to be here at Looking Glass Theater and a co-production, a collaboration of FMT Radio and Chicago Magazine. And we're on the set of what is going to be a Black Diamond. I can tell you nothing about it because it hasn't opened yet, but it's going to be an amazing play set in modern Liberia. We're going to have a break at about 12:30. You're going to get to hear questions from the audience. Oh, and I have to say that Anne Lamott here, the reason you are here, has been described as Christianity's Howard Stern. But, you know, I really think that's selling her short. I do. I mean, how many authors can you actually think of who can tackle topics like alcoholism, motherhood, aging thighs, Jesus, politics, binge eating, teen turmoil, bad hair, and forgiveness, all with the same amount of honesty, passion, and humor? There are very few people who can do that, both in fiction and nonfiction. In fact, Lamott has published 6 novels, 5 works of nonfiction. She wrote an award-winning online diary for Salon.com. She's been the subject of a documentary film back in 1999. She was also a teen-aged tennis star. You might not know that. And we know that she has inspired a huge number of people in so many different ways. Her new book is Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith. And while she may be the darling of the liberal Christian group everywhere, you do not need to believe in anything at all in order to believe in Anne Lamott. Thank you so much for being here. And may I just say that you have get the prize here for the most rabid, devoted, like, crazed group of, like, fans who just adore you. I've had people stalking me for the last 2 weeks trying to get tickets. I actually could have made money for once off of one of these. I could have sold tickets. People would have bought tickets, right? You would have all bought tickets. And, you know, it speaks, I think, to how deeply you move people.
Oh, thank you.
I know you're aware of that. This book, Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith, has been kind of billed as the third in, I don't know if it's considered a series or people are seeing it as a series, in of books that you have written focusing on faith, although there is so much between the covers that really does not directly necessarily speak to that. I think it's kind of an unfair way of positioning it. There are, I think, 23 essays in the book. 8 of them are new. A lot of them have been published elsewhere. Why this book now, and what is it that made you decide, on this particular group of essays for this particular book?
Well, the first collection was called Traveling Mercies, and it was written during the Clinton years when I was in a much better mood. And there's much less about politics in it. There's a lot about having a little son, a young child, and about it's a lot about grief because I always used to tell my writing students, write what you'd love to come upon. And when my best friend died, I really couldn't find material that made any sense to me in terms of how the grief experience was for me, which was very erratic and kind of unending. And most books or things on grief seem to say that at some point, maybe not after too much longer, one hoped, the grief would end. And my experience is that that's not natural and that it takes whatever it takes. And so I wanted to write that kind of book. And, you know, I basically want to say you don't ever get over the loss of certain people. And I don't want anyone to get over the loss of me. They should, for the rest of their lives, they should think about how much more fun everything was when I was around. And but so there was a lot of grief. It was closer to my friend's death and not so much about politics. Then with Plan B, I was my second collection, I was in a really bad mood. And the first line of it is that I woke up on my 49th birthday and had decided to kill myself because I couldn't do one more week with the current administration and I was going to eat myself to death. But then I realized there was no food in the house. And also my back was out and I didn't want to die in crone mode. Plan B is an angrier book, and yet, you know, these little pieces just keep coming to me. They're 10, 8, 9, 10 pages, but I love the length, and I love to read them. And I love that there's sort of immediate gratification. After a week of hard work, I feel pretty good about one of them. But in this book, what's different is that their time is running out, and now I can watch the president. And instead of just clawing at my skin, I think, tick, tock, tick, tock. And my son is older. In Plan B, he was 13 and 14, and I was getting a lot of what you're in for, which is that the plates of the earth shift, and they get mouthier, and you become more of an embarrassment to them. But at the same time, they're still, I used to call them, I think of there being Sam, and then there'd be Phil. And that would be like Sam at his most awful. And I think Phil's here. And but it was manageable. And then 16 and 17 were very hard. Yeah. So this is a book that is happier politically and struggling to be a decent mother and set lots and lots of boundaries, but to be pleasant about it. And it's just a very, very different time in our country also.
Why don't you start with, let's have a little reading from you. And actually, what you're going to read is the very first essay in the book, Ski Patrol. And I think it's just, it's a great one to start with.
Okay, actually, the first piece is called Prelude. And, but that's okay, I'm not saying. I'm
I didn't
just saying,
count that.
That's okay. But the other day I did an interview from my hotel room in Boston with an NPR commentator from the South. And he had only read the Dust Jacket copy, and he kept referring to it as your opening statements. And I couldn't place any of the words because I didn't write them. You know, you don't write your own Dust Jacket copy. And then he'd say, well, there's something interesting in the opening statement that says this. I wish grace and healing were more abracadabra kinds of things. Also, that silver bells would ring to announce grace's arrival. Now, and I'd think, okay. And he'd say, can you just talk to us more about the writing process? And I would say, I didn't write it, you know, but I was too nice to say it. So we just kept talking about my opening statement. So anyway, this is from a piece called Ski Patrol. Not too long ago, I was skiing in the mountains where my son Sam and I spend a weekend most winters. Nowadays, he instantly disappears with the hordes of snowboarders. I believe he is somewhat embarrassed to be seen with me. Once, standing next to him and his friend at the bottom of a hill, I fell over for no reason. And in fact, the very first time we went skiing together, I skied in a strangely slow, inexorable path for 100 feet or so, straight into a huge net at the bottom of the slopes, erected there to protect the small ski bear children from being crushed. Then I got tangled up in it like a fish. After Sam disappears, I usually take the chairlift to the top of the pony slope for a couple of runs, which anyone can manage. And I triumph. I roar down the slight incline, pretending to be an Olympic skier. Filled with confidence, I try the easiest intermediate slope, which I mostly fall or slide down on my butt for the first run, and then have a few extended runs of 4 or 5 minutes when I'm actually skiing. By my second run down an intermediate slope, I am on my feet almost the whole time, skiing triumphantly for America. But this time, as the chairlift carried me to the top of the intermediate slope, which I had just skied down, I experienced a moment's confusion, born of hormones, high altitude, and a light snow falling. I suddenly could not remember whether the stop we were approaching was the same one I had just skied down from. The chair slowed and lowered for us to disembark, and my seatmate got off and zipped away like a swallow, while I sat there torn between wanting to get off and thinking that mine was the next stop. The chair jerked forward and resumed its ascent. I looked around for landmarks but saw only brightly colored skiers and clusters, and I was pretty sure that this was not the right stop, until a second later when I realized I was mistaken. It was the right stop. By then, the chair was 4 or 5 feet off the ground and rising, but I did not let this stop me. I took a long, deep breath, wriggled to the edge of the chair, and flung myself off into the snow. Flung myself the way stuntmen fling themselves onto the back of speeding trains, or a clown flings himself from a bucking bronco, mugging bug-eyed for the crowd. I estimate that I was 5 or 6 feet off the ground for the timeless instant of eternity before I crashed down into the snow. I landed hard, proving the theory of gravity once and for all. I was somehow still on my skis for a moment until I fell over. I do not imagine that anyone had seen anything like this before. Someone hurtling into outer space with such force from such a low starting point. I felt like Icarus near death in the snow, with melting skis instead of wings. I was immediately aware of two things, that I was not badly hurt, and that most people were pretending not to have noticed, out of kindness or horror or mortification. I am ever my mother's daughter, and so my first impulse was to smile with confidence to the few who were watching, and wave like a politician campaigning from a rarely used horizontal position. I'm okay, I said to two pretty women who came over and offered to pull me up. I continued to wave nonchalantly, as if this sort of silly thing happened to me all the time. I told them that I just needed to catch my breath. They made sympathetic cooing sounds and skied away. I sat up and leaned back on my hands in the snow. By the time I finally stood up, my hands were frozen. I was winded, ashamed, confused, and bruised, grateful only that Sam hadn't seen me. He would have died. He would have stabbed himself repeatedly in the head with his ski poles.
Anne Lamott reading from Grace Eventually. I thought that was such a great microcosm of your work, because it's self-deprecating. It puts you in this kind of embarrassing position, so you instantly gain our sympathy. And then a little while, and Sam's in there, and later on, this moment of grace that enters into all of these stories comes in the form of a rescuer in a quiet moment. And it seems to me that all of your story, all of your essays have this moment that begins with you doing something that you have to almost expiate later. Like, can you believe I did this? And then, you know, then you find a way out into this kind of light.
But also, it's also meant to be encouraging to people who want to do something that they're not very good at. Like, obviously, I'm a terrible skier, but I'm a very enthusiastic skier at the same time. And I think it's incredibly brave for a postmenopausal woman to get up on the intermediate slope being a terrible skier and ski down. I mean, it's heroic, really. And then... And then also, everybody that wants to do anything, if you want to start writing, if you want to start learning a musical instrument, you have to be willing to be bad at it. It's, you don't want to learn to play the piano so you can botch Farmer in the Dell. You know, you want to play the piano so you can play Brahms. And I didn't learn to ski so I could ski like this, you know. And I've actually gotten a little bit better because I do the single most important thing when it comes to learning piano or writing, which is that I've kept at it. So it also includes this encouragement to practice radical silliness and to do it anyway, just because it's in your, it's on your heart to do it.
Well, that's in a section of the book. It's actually divided into, I think, seven different categories, and they're fairly loose, but that one is mainly about physical things that you're trying, and there's dancing, and there's a bunch of things. And later on, there's a category that I think really resonated with me, and that was the forgiveness category, where you're just like really ticked off at a whole lot of people and you find your way through various means to try and forgive them. One of those stories, I think it was Nudges, is about some people that you knew, this is going back a while, like almost 20 years, who you just, man, you envied them. They did really well financially. They were reaching out to you. You and Sam went and spent time at the seashore with them. And it kind of ended up driving you crazy, and you had a very difficult situation with them that 12 years later you tried to rectify. So that's a section where you're really trying to show people another thing that they can live up to.
Yeah, the book, I was calling the book Forgivishness for a long time because I am one of those Christians who is just terrible at forgiveness. You know, it's like the only thing you have to try to even be halfway good at, and it is just not my strong suit. And, oh, God, I let go every so often, but I've said every time I've talked about forgiveness that everything I let go of has claw marks on it. And it is such a struggle for me. And these people hurt my feelings so much by their constantly, like Sam and I were living in what I describe in the book as being a very, very nice rat trap, and it had termites. And they would say things like, you have got to come see the summer home. You're going to love it. And I would just be like, I hate you so much, you know. Why don't you tell that to people who already have one home, you know? And it's not my strong suit. I think I'm more of a reform Christian. And it's like David Roach's Church of 80% Sincerity in Plan B. 80% of anything is like a miracle, you know, and forgiving 80% of the time, which is what I do, is really astounding. I don't think we'd forgive. I think we have become available to receive something that makes it possible for us to say the words. And I've always believed you take the action first and then the insight follows, that you don't break hard codes in your head. You don't figure it all out in the meaning of life. You take the action, the next right step. So finally, we didn't talk after this disastrous vacation I wrote about in the book for 12 years. And then I don't know why I hadn't felt it before, but I felt that nudge on my heart to clean up my own mess, to clean up my side of the street, and to kind of put my money where my mouth is so that Sam can see that you take a long, deep breath and you say those words, I was really awful.
Yet their side of the street is still messy because they never responded.
But that's not my business. See, it's
and you
not
still
my,
haven't heard from them? You think you
I
might?
Never heard back. But I did the right thing. I wrote to them and I said, I was so awful. And I'm so sorry. And I have no excuse. And I just hope that the damage I did was short-lived or something like that. And I never heard back, but that's not my problem. And I got the hit. I got the reward because I did it, and it was scary and weird. And I kind of part of me doesn't quite forgive them, but the part of me, you know, 80% of me forgives them. And before, 0% of me forgave them. And so that was so huge that you have to act on that. Yeah.
Some reviewers have said that this is actually your darkest book, and I think it's only based on one essay in it, because most of the book is not that way. But the essay that's the darkest and will probably in some way stir people up the most was the essay called Death's Window, At Death's Window, mm-hmm. which was actually, I think, published first in the LA Times.
Yes.
And it's about your assisting in the suicide of a very good friend.
Yes.
And this is probably the one essay in the book that does not have an underlying wit to it. It's really just matter of fact and very humane and passionate about what you were doing. But that's got to be stirring up the people that have already, I mean, the Christianity blogs that I checked out are just, they really are kind of like your frying lady.
Yeah. I had a huge event that was a book event, but it being held at a church canceled because it was going to freak so many people out, which I really understand. I mean, I didn't feel bad about it. I felt you really have to the pastor, you have to really take care of your people, you know. And but there's actually two kind of dark pieces. There's a piece on, and I think it's not as dark as Plan B because I was so angry with Bush. I mean, I still can't stand the guy, and I can't wait to run him out of office, but I'm not as so angry anymore for obvious reasons. But I was on stage doing an event for to galvanize progressive spiritual people of all faith, I thought. And there were 1,500 people in this hotel ballroom. And a man stood up and asked how left-wing Christians could reconcile their faith to Roe versus, well, what? No, he didn't say to Roe v. Wade. What he said was to the murder of 3 million children in America every year, to the youngest and most vulnerable Americans, as Bush does. Well, that's what Bush calls the snowflake babies, the embryos. And so at first I was on a panel and I thought I'll let it pass because everybody else had a very beautiful response and a more progressive way of looking at it. And I thought, I can't let this pass. You know, that'd be so chicken. And so I stood up and I said, you cannot force women to act against their deepest truth and to betray their knowledge and understanding and the knowledge that is so hard fought. And you can't inflict life on children that aren't going to be cared for because the government, this government won't care for them once they're born. And you cannot, you don't want to inflict unwanted children into society, you know. And then I said in the book, Paul is a good word because this Paul fell over the room because they were all Catholics. There were like 1,500 Catholics. But see, I'd flown in on the red eye special and I'd gotten there not that long before the event started. And I was kind of staggering around with jet lag and I didn't know that they were mostly Catholics. And I would have never kind of been so adamant. I would have said, you know what? The opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. And a lot of Americans have really had just about enough of being told what very, very few things we can think and do for our country, for our families, for our own deepest selves. So, and it was a disaster, and this doesn't get better. Except that one very old woman came up to me later, and we started gobbling down M&Ms to calm ourselves, and she said, if you hadn't said something, I would have spit. But, so I love that, but that's not a happy story. But
that's a different, that's The Born, that is in this book
that's
too.
A piece called The Born, where I feel that the rights of the born supersede the rights of the unborn to me. And I, you know, the Christian right wing and the Christian mainstream get to say whatever they want to, and they get to think and believe whatever they want to. And it still doesn't mean I want them running my government, you know, and it means I get to have the same rights. I have the same right. And what the most precious gift this country has given to civilization is democracy and the separation of church and state. And it was the first great idea to come along since, you know, Constantine. And for that to have been so thoroughly trashed and amended breaks my heart. But I'm getting off the subject. I'm glad to talk about this piece at Death Window because I think it's important that people disseminate whatever truth they can, even if it's scary. Skip it if you don't want to read it. You know, I've told people that have come to the readings, there's a piece that might be a little scary that a 12-year-old might not want to talk about it afterwards. I'll read it at the very end and there'll be time for you to leave if you choose.
Have people, do you find that in general, the people that respond, do you respond because they are faith-based or because they're literary or because they are political? Or do you find, I mean, it'd be actually, how many of you are here because you just have a literary interest versus, I don't know, raise your hands if you're, I don't know, really religious, let's say.
See, no one's going to raise your hand. Okay, we got
okay,
a few.
Okay, so really, you're not, okay.
There's a few of them.
Because so many people do, I think, try and peg you as like a faith-based writer. And I, nice Jewish girl that I am, and yes, I want to join, you know, St. Andrews because they seem like a great group of people. But
yeah.
I'm not reading you for the inspiration of faith.
No, Christian bookstores will not carry me because I'm too provocative and I'm too angry and because I don't buy it. It's not what Jesus was talking about. There's not a, Jesus doesn't say a word about sex. He doesn't say a word about who you choose to love and be loved by. It's not a word.
Well, you've got a great relationship. I have to say that your characterization of Jesus, for somebody like me who's had absolutely no experience of the Trinity whatsoever, except from the history of art, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you have characterized him as, you know, a little cat who kind of stalks you when you had your conversion experience. And then he's this guy swigging beer. And I mean, you've said things about him that have really roiled people. And yet you seem to have a very, very personal, comfy experience. It's a humorous kind of relationship.
It's a very, very simplistic relationship, too. I teach Sunday school to the little kids, the 3 to 6-year-olds. I mean, don't get me started. And it's really hard. And I really love it, love it, love it. And I really don't understand too much more about religion and faith. And I can't stand organized religion. That's why I'm at St. Andrew. It's extremely disorganized. But I don't understand much more than what I teach the kids, which is that they're okay. It's a come-as-you-are party. And they're welcome. And they're chosen. And some days are going to go better than others. And when things go really, really badly, you can call a friend. You get to tell the truth. You don't have to keep secrets. And you get to, and maybe it might help if you sit down for a minute and have a drink of water. That's about how much I understand. And so I don't actually seem to get attacked so much for saying, like there's a line in this piece on beauty, a field theory of beauty, where I said I've got cellulite that would make Jesus weep. I don't get attacked for that. I get attacked because I'm pro women's rights. I'm pro abortion. I'm pro gay marriage, obviously. I mean, I've got an extremely left wing political agenda and I live by it. And the gospel is, I read it as a social gospel, as a gospel of social justice. And Jesus is like, if you see people that are really thirsty, you could go get them a drink of water. You could sit with them maybe for a minute if they seem worried or sad. And could you all try not to kill anyone today? That would be so cool. And maybe you would want to write a note to yourself and tape it by the phone. And, you know, I think my personal belief is that if we could do the golden rule 80%, that Jesus would be thrilled. And that's what I get beaten up for. I got a lot of calls in the days before I've gotten to Chicago from people saying how wrong I am and that it's right there in the Bible that Jesus really hates gays and they just make him so sick and he hates fat people too, you know, and that it's all just there. But I don't believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible. I believe in it. I have a relationship with Jesus and it's not sophisticated.
We're going to hear a little bit more about that after this break. We'll be back with Anne Lamott talking about her new book, Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
On 98.7 FM, WFMT, Writers on the Record, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who have published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by Maven Chronicles and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. Come to the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. In beautiful Hyde Park, 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is where serious readers go for fun. Enjoy a wide selection of titles in a unique space that's perfect for browsing. Specialties include literature, mysteries, children's books, cookbooks, and travel. The Newberry Library Bookstore at 60 West Walton carries a distinctive selection of books, cards, and gifts in a beautiful landmark setting. Specialties include Native American studies, history, genealogy, cartography, calligraphy, and music. And the Seminary Co-op at 5757 South University Avenue, across from the University of Chicago Quad, enjoys a reputation as one of the best academic bookstores anywhere. Known for the breadth and depth of its inventory, the co-op carries more than 100,000 titles in a wide range of disciplines. Visit the Seminary Co-op bookstores in person. Call toll-free 800-777-1456 or look up semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record takes place Sunday, April 22nd, when Victoria Lautman talks with Anchi Min. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman's guest is Anne Lamott.
Thank you. Welcome back to Writers on the Record. This is our break. This is where I get to tell you about what's coming up in the next couple months. Anchi Min is going to be here on the 22nd of April talking about her new book, followed by Arthur Phillips on May 20th, and then I have Nathan Englander on June 24th. They're all excellent authors. You should start calling now because, as you know, people, this really is beginning to fill up very quickly, finally, after 3 years. Then we're going to go on a hiatus for the summer. But right now we're talking to Anne Lamott about her new book, Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith. And, you know, there's so much of people who have read you for the last 20 years. And I'm thinking, starting for me in 1994 with Operating Instructions. And then I haven't even mentioned any of the other books in case people don't know. Operating Instructions. Then there was Bird by Bird about the writer's life, life and writing, 1994. Traveling Mercies was from 99. But also these six novels, including Hard Laughter from 1980, the first book, and Blue Shoe, which was the New York Times bestseller back in 2002. Collectively, people who read these things, I mean, I feel like I know you pretty intimately. It's such a weird relationship that you set up between yourself and the public, and also between Sam and the public, people who have kind of grown up the last 20 years with you. And starting 25 years ago, we also know that for the last 20, you've been sober. It took you that 5 years in there to actually get clean. You had your conversion experience. And we know...
I had the conversion experience a year before I got clean and sober.
Right. There was this like interesting overlap there. Where I think you said that, actually, and I interpreted this as the biggest rebellion of all time against your parents. Most people, you know, would consider, you know, drugs and alcohol and pregnancy rebellious. But the fact that you converted to being, to accepting this religious life was the most rebellious thing you could possibly have done. You were raised as a, you know, an atheist to think that anybody with religion was insane. Your parents, I wonder actually if you would have been able to have accepted Christianity as you did if your father was even still alive. Could you have gone to your dad, who I think was the one more responsible for making you feel like you couldn't do this?
Well, that's a good question. My father died when I was 25, and I converted at 31 and got sober at 32. Another question would have been, could I have gotten sober with my father still alive, because he was a very enthusiastic drinker. And I'd had this spiritual life. I've written a lot about it in Grace Eventually, and I wrote a lot about it in actually all the books. And I always believed that there was some power greater than us that was just about goodness, and that it could be that when you prayed, something heard, and that when you got really, really quiet and you did all the stuff that basically every single religion agrees on, which is that you take care of others, you get out of yourself to be there for others. If you want to feel rich, you give away more. That you feed the hungry and the thirsty and the poor, and that the poor are very, very, very special to God. I had all that going, and it really helped me through my father's 2-year death from brain cancer. But the one thing I want to say first is, you feel that you know me really intimately, but the stuff I write about is stuff that I am so comfortable with. I don't write it as often as I'm certainly in the middle of the crisis of it. I write it when, it's like if there's a bullseye, in the circle of it, there's really me and Jesus and the animals, Lily and Jeannie. And they're in the bullseye. And in the next circle out are several absolutely trusted with anything friends. And in the next circle out, there's a bunch of people I could talk to about this terrible binge I had that I write about in this book, or the thing with Sam. There are a number of people, other parents I could talk to about certain things. And then there's the stuff I write about and publish. And so it's I'm pretty comfortable, and I'm also convinced it's universal, and that I have details of it, and that I have a way of telling stories that is different, and that people like the sound of my voice, whether it's written or spoken. So I do. I know people feel that a real sense of connection with me, and I love that. And I feel just a moment's connection with people that are here, that are being kind to me, or saying nice things. But I feel a connection with not because I've exposed myself. You don't. I mean, the stuff I could tell you, when people sometimes they'll say, oh my God, I can't believe I'm meeting you. I go, God, if you could just watch like the video, you know, or if of my life, or if my mind had a live feed onto the internet, you know, you'd be horrified. You'd be coilless from hot flame. But it would probably be very similar to the stuff we all think, where I believe when all is said and done, we're all in the same boat.
Well, the video that you play in your mind sometimes, I think, does come out. It's your decision to present these things to a public that I think is a really interesting moment going on in you. And I want you to read from Samwheel in the book, which was first published in Salon.com. And when I went to the site and looked, compared responses from this diary entry years ago to other ones you did, there were 470 responses to it, many of them deeply negative.
Almost all of them deeply negative. This is a piece in which I did something. I'll read it to you, and then we can talk about it. This is a dark piece for me. It's called Samwheel, because he couldn't say Samuel when he was little, because he couldn't say Elf till he was about five. But he knew Samuel was a very prestigious name and very profound name in the Old Testament. And so he called himself Samwheel. So there are only six stories about Sam at 17 that he'll allow me to tell. And this is my favorite. It's about a fight we had once that left me wondering whether anyone in history had ever been a worse parent or raised such an awful child. It challenged my belief that there is meaning to life and that we are children of divine intelligence and design. Our fight was ostensibly about the car. We have an old beater that I let Sam drive whenever he wants, although because I pay for the insurance, I have some leverage. It's a good deal for him. But I had taken away his car privileges earlier in the week because he'd been driving recklessly, hitting a curb going 20, and destroyed the front tire. So he felt mad and victimized to begin with, my big, handsome, brown-eyed son. And actually, so did I. I asked him to wash both cars as partial payment for the tire I'd had to buy. It was a beautiful sunny day, and he had other plans, which I made him postpone. I went for a walk with the dog to let him work in peace. When I got back, the cars were still gauzy with dirt. I pointed this out as nicely as possible. I washed him, Sam said defiantly. You liar, I said in an affectionate way, because his response was so flagrantly not true that I assumed he was just joking. He produced two filthy wash rags. I'm not a liar, he said. I just did a lousy job. Turning to walk away, he looked back and gave me a catalytic sneer. It was as if something had tripped a spring-loaded bar in me, and for the first time in our lives, I slapped him on the face. He didn't flinch. In fact, he barely seemed to register it. He gave me a flat, lifeless look, and I knew that I was a doomed human being and that neither of us could ever forgive me. Then I grounded him for the night. I felt I had no choice. Slapping him did not neutralize his culpability. It simply augmented mine. He looked at me with scorn. I don't care what you do or don't do anymore, he said. You have no power over me. This is not strictly true. He has very little money of his own, and he loves having our old car to tool around in. Also, he realizes that families are not democracies, and so he's smart enough to obey most of the time. We stood in the driveway looking daggers at each other. The tension was like the air before a lightning storm. The cat ran for her life. The dog wrung her hands. I felt a wall of tears approaching the shore, and without another thought, I got in my car and left. Nothing makes me angrier, nothing makes me feel more hopeless than when someone robs me of my reality by trying to gaslight me. Like Charles Boyer with Ingrid Bergman in Gaslight, saying he hadn't seen her purse when actually he'd hidden it, or lowering the gas jets and then pretending not to have noticed the darkness. I started to cry hard, and not long after, to actually keen, like an Irish woman with a son missing at sea, which is what it had felt like, and what it feels like to have a 16 and 17-year-old during really bad patches, like you've lost him.
There's a moment where you really, Sam now only allows you to write seven stories from this particular time in his life. And
six.
Six. And he, you paid him for some of the stories from when he was about 10. He got veto power.
Yeah, yeah.
People, I guess one of your reviewers said that we are all like Sam's godparents. We've seen this kid from birth to now. And it is such an unusual position to be in as a member of the reading public, and also as a parent, and also as Sam. And you described this in an interview to me as, you know, it's like you have created this incredible video library of your life with this child.
For him and me, yeah.
Yeah. And yet it has this wider life. And I'm wondering now, as Sam goes out into the world, almost 18, where will Sam be in your work next?
Well, he's moved out. He graduated from high school, and he's studying in North, firefighting, poetry, psychology, and spirituality in Washington State. And we had such bad times for about 6 months, and then we had so much work on ourselves, therapeutic healing work on ourselves, and he is happier than he's ever been in his life. He's a great son. I mean, a mother couldn't hope for a funnier and sweeter son. He's just so dear, and he's so hilarious. In Plan B, I wrote one of his favorite lines was when he realized how much taller than me he was. And I'm 5'7", and he came in to hug me once, and he patted me on the head and said, "When did this happen?" And I said, "It just did over time." And he said, "You're like a little gnome to me now." And but so with this piece especially, I showed it to him way before I published, and he gave it back, and he said, "You can only run this if you make yourself look as bad as I do." And I definitely thought I would looked awful. I mean, God, I'm like a pacifist. I go to every peace march they hold. You know, I hold my little signs. I wear little signs that say pro-soldier, pro-peace, and then I slap my son, and it was awful, awful. But there was alchemy. And I would say that it was grace, because I believe in grace and I live by it. And somebody who doesn't see the world with spiritual terms would say that love is just so powerful. It's love or God or whatever you would want, or grace, whatever you would call it, is so much bigger than our comfort zones. And we can know so little, I think, about God. But at any rate, we, at the end of the story, I'll ruin this for you, but it gets bad, and then all of a sudden I'm asleep on the couch in the living room, and I look up and Sam is watching TV on the other couch, and he's in the living room. After this, and after being grounded and losing the car, something has jiggled. It's like a lava lamp, you know? We're not stuck, and we're not who we are. We're only who we are for any given moment, for a given moment. And the lava lamp had worked inside of him, and he had come and stretched out on the other couch. I said hi, and he wasn't ready to say hi. And I went back to sleep. In about half an hour, I woke up, and he's sleeping on the other couch. And we're back in circulation, and we're breathing again. We're dreaming at the same time. We're in the same room. And that is a brown bag miracle. It's not like God has a magic wand, and it was like, "Thank you, Mom, for being strict and keeping me in this corral because, you know, even though none of the other kids' parents make them make their beds, I know I will be glad someday that you do. You know, that's not what had happened, but we both fell asleep. We took a nap together in the same room. You know, and I want to say, it's very important that you make your kids make their beds. It really is. It's when they go out into the world, it's going to be you can't treat other people the way you treat your family. And it doesn't fly in real life. It only flies if you have mothers who are black belt codependent. So I say, if you have younger children, say, you know what, something exciting is going on in this house. You have become big enough that we have two chores for you now. One is that you make your bed when you get out of it, and the other is that you do your laundry. And I mean, it's a really good start. Anyway, okay. Anyway,
good one. It's been what, 2002 since you wrote Blue Shoe? So we've got, you know, 5 years since your last fictional book.
Yes,
I'm really interested in, because there really are very few writers who seem really to be evenly paced between their fictional works and their nonfiction. And I know it probably requires a completely different focus, although there's a lot of overlap. And if you read, your books are still very semi-autobiographical. Mm-hmm. And some of the same events seem to transpire between the two. Is there kind of like a mechanism in you that builds up and you get all this kind of nonfiction stuff and then suddenly it needs to express itself in fiction? Or will you?
Oh, that's a really good way to put it. The way I would capture it is that these short pieces are done in a week. You know, and then
but like in six different drafts.
In six different drafts, and the truth is that on the Monday when I start working again on a short piece or a novel, when I'm done with this book tour, I'm going to be in the exact same soup that every writer here is in, which is I'm not going to go, God, this, I'm starting my 12th book, and all these people showed up in Chicago, and I'm not going to think that. I'm going to think what you think. I'm going to think, oh, my God, it's so hopeless. And talk about beating a dead horse, and the well is run dry, and God, and there was that one review, and those 489 letters at Salon that attacked me, and think I'm, and I mean, one of the letters in Salon reacting to this piece, I just have to say, where I slapped Sam, lumped me in with the pedophile priests. And they said, once you have begun to abuse a child, it's a continuum. So it's like, well, thank you for sharing. You know, I don't actually see it that way. But it's like what you can say to Christians who are being too assertive is to say, thank you for sharing that with me. You know what? I don't agree with you. And move on. But at any rate, I do have struggle with everything I write. And my first drafts are awful, and they're too long, and they're overwrought. And I try to be funny so you won't think I'm secretly a depressive, and or that it won't make you too worried or trigger some unhappy memory you have of childhood. So, and then on the second day, I take all that stuff out. And I take out all the humor that's forced. And on the third day, I have a very solid working draft. And on the fourth draft, I start getting very firm. And bird by bird, I said that the first draft is a down draft. You get everything down. The second draft is the up draft. And you start cleaning things up. And the third draft is the dental draft, where you go tooth by tooth or chapter by chapter or paragraph by paragraph. And you clean it, or you pull it, or you see if it's okay. You see if it's strong enough to stay. So by Friday, I have a decent piece. I don't publish everything I write. And I had the benevolent pressure of Salon to get these nonfiction pieces done. And when I used to teach writing, besides saying, write what you'd love to come upon, I'd say nothing is as effective as having some benevolent pressure. You know, it's having somebody that's waiting and maybe drumming their fingers on the table because you promised another 10 pages. And so some of the best stuff that came out of all those years of writing groups was people forming writing groups and still meeting in some cases 15 years later. Every second Thursday, you got to bring 8 more new pages. You got to have a copy for everyone. They really keep you honest. And it's the sweetest, most benevolent pressure, where it's not like teachers breathing down your back, or, you know, your mother saying that an A- is, it's not that disappointing, but it wouldn't, how much more effort would it have taken to get an A? It's the pressure of colleagues who are trying to help you get you working at the highest level you could, and then trying to help you burnish the work. A novel takes me 3 years. It takes an easy 3 years. And the difference in how I would capture it, the work, is that you have to have a certain stamina for a novel. Now, some people, like my friend Bill's wife, Elizabeth Berg. I think she writes much more prolifically than I do, and she writes beautifully. She seems to write a lot faster than I do. I have an awful time. And all I know is that for the first draft, I don't know who the characters are really. And so, and I have a friend, Mark Childress, who's another great writer who from the South, from Alabama, who wrote so many books, Crazy in Alabama. He's working on a new book. He just had a book that was a huge hit called, now my mind is going to go blank, but I'll remember it later, as soon as we're off the air. So I'll remember it off the air. But he's been working on a new novel, and it had been awful, and it's about depression and anxiety. And then finally, I talked to him, and he had had about 3 months of daily work, and he's a very serious. His book is called One Mississippi. It's the greatest title, so it's easy to remember, because I kept telling him I was going to use it, but because such a perfect title. But finally, he said, oh, it's starting to go well. And I said, where are you? He said, I'm starting chapter two. And it had been 3 months of a 35, 40-hour week. So, and that's what it's going to be like for me. And you have to, it's like you have to build, something inside of you has to build up and build up. And your subconscious when you're writing and your unconscious, their job anyway is to run around and gather rags for the rag bag, you know, for the rag bag guy, who I think is like a Dr. Seuss person deep inside of us. And the rags are memories or moments or scenes or ideas and whatnot, and bits of thread and bits of cloth or beautiful stuff that you can attach the rags with. And you got to have a feeling of fullness before you can put yourself at such risk as to say out loud that you're starting another novel.
This would be a good time for if just a few of you want to position yourselves in front of the microphone, make your way over the crowd. If you want to ask questions, we can take a few now. And while you're kicking your way to the front, you know, it's interesting that you have been such an inspiration to writers for so long through Bird by Bird and your whole life, basically. And I read on the Stephen Barclay Agency website that they must have just been inundated at one point with manuscripts. They said, please do not send us unsolicited manuscripts for Anne Lamott. Anne Lamott will not be looking at your manuscript. And furthermore, you will not be getting your manuscript back, so don't send us your manuscript.
Oh, dude, I don't think I've ever actually logged on to my page at Steve's agency.
Check it out. Interesting.
I won't even put with best wishes anymore, so I'm definitely not going to be reading your manuscript.
Okay, let's see. We have a question over here.
It's been said by... Am I here?
Yeah.
You are there.
It's been said by various people in various walks that it's when we're at our most broken that grace can come in.
Yes.
Is there anything in particular that you're struggling with or hitting a bottom with right now? That, you know what I mean?
Oh,
she's in the middle of a really long book tour.
I'm dealing with Sam having graduated from high school and having moved out, even though I get to see him every month. Yeah, I'm dealing with that. Why? I mean, because I feel grace abounding. And in a certain way, I've never felt calmer and more grateful, you know, because we have been carried so far. We have had such a remarkable, astonishing adventure. He adores me. I mean, he said to me the funniest thing the other day by phone, because he's finally discovered me, you know. Before, he only read the pieces that he was in and that I showed to him to get the okay. And so now he's reading stuff I've written. He goes, God, Mom, you're really good, you know. So thank you, honey. And then he said, you know, this is like having my own private tribal elder. So I've been feeling very squinty, but when your kid is complimenting you on your life's work, it's profound. But I'm struggling. I hate that he's gone. I wish he lived nearby.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Yeah.
I hope that I can reach this. you talked about humor, and I've heard it said that people that write humor are basically angry people and people that, you know...
Yeah, like Charlie Chaplin. It's famous. It's a very famous
truth.
Yeah.
Right. And you also talked about writing things that are humorous that you feel are forced. And I'm just wondering for you how you deal with those two things and what kinds of things come out of your search for humor that really is authentic and tickles your funny bone and yet mm-hmm. still says what you want to say out of your anger.
Uh-huh. That's a good question. I want to say, for one thing, I'm a lot less angry. I've always said I wouldn't give back a year of my life. I love every single year that I've lived. I wish I had, like, grown up wearing sunscreen and turtlenecks, but who knew back then? I mean, in the 50s, no one knew. There was one kind of sunscreen, Cianski, and then finally, copper tone. But I'm much less angry, and I'm much less angry about the Bush administration because I got so much healing from my church and from being willing to say it. And I went up to the altar call, where usually you go up if you're really sick or really mentally struggling, or if someone you love is sick, and few people might go up and the pastor would pray with them and with the whole congregation. And I would go up, this 2 years ago, I go up, I hate them so much, Veronica. I hate them. I feel that it's made me mentally ill. And I really, I felt the day after the 2004 election and for the next couple weeks as challenged and hopeless as I've ever felt in my life, even through Pammy's death and my father's. And Veronica didn't judge me or shame me or fix me or try to spackle me. She said, it's so good that you brought this up to us, that you're bringing it up to us, because there is nothing as amazing as telling the truth and not pretending that you're doing fine. I mean, that's what Bush has been doing. This is a man with no self-esteem, obviously, who had to do that mission accomplished event to try to, you know, pump himself up, who had to destroy a country because he's so lost and so angry and can't express it because he's a born-again Christian. He was born the day he and Billy Graham prayed, and the day he got sober. I want to say nicely, lovingly, that Billy Graham prayed with Nixon the night before they bombed Cambodia. But I think that anger and hatred turn you into Shiites, Muslims, or Shiite Christians, and it makes you crazy. So I think it's important to share that somebody who's so on the side of peace and love as I am has had to slog her way through it too. So I write draft and draft and draft to try to get it right. All I can say is find someone who will read your material for you and let you know if they think you've crossed a line. Okay, one last question, then we got to go.
As a writer, have you ever abandoned a project you were working on? And if so, how did you know when it was time to just let it go?
Oh, God, that's such a great question, because I actually had written a couple drafts of Rosie when I got a letter from my editor at Viking Penguin. This is 25 years ago. It said, this is the hardest letter I've ever had to write, but this is a book that you wrote that you needed to get out of the way, and now you need to put it in your desk drawer and get on with the next book. Well, luckily, I was still drinking at the time. And what I did with it was to, I wrote about it in Bird by Bird. I mean, it's a long story, but I committed to the characters. I was so committed to the characters. I thought, it may be true that the writing's bad. It may be true that I'm not telling this story well, but I loved the characters, and I made a commitment to them. And then I ended up being able to kind of break it open like a tile, like a mosaic or something, and get to know each little shard again and to start to figure out how to really arrange them just right. But I can say honestly, I've abandoned a lot of short pieces, but usually several months into a novel, I can tell whether I'm going to be able to commit to these people for 3 years and whether it's anything different. I always write about the same things. I write about how really hard it is to be human, and how our work is really to forgive and to become as deeply alive and as we can, and to be as much of a solution for the people that are suffering so in the world. I write the same book kind of over and over again, but I keep getting away with it, you know, so stop me. No, so anyway, so I haven't had to abandon. I know people who, and I think it's the bravest thing on earth to abandon 100 pages of a novel that you suddenly, it's like changing course in the Iraq War. It would be so profound and brave, and Bush could become a hero again. Maybe it's a little late, but but to change your mind and to go, you know what, this is not right. And I've got to figure out what plan B is. It's very brave. And I haven't had to do it with a novel yet, but it's a big yet for me. So thank you. It's a good question.
A Well, I have like 20 more questions, but there's no way to get them in. And so I'm going to have to let you go. I want to remind people, though, that, you know, we are selling a lot of the back issues of books here, not back issues, but earlier on the list, so you can get operating instructions bird by bird. If you haven't read all of Anne Lamott's or any of them, you know, this is a really good time to start. And we're hoping to see all of you back here next month for An Chi Minh. In the meanwhile, Anne Lamott, thank you so much.
Yeah,
we all
thank
wish you,
you
very
thank
well.
Thank you, Victoria. Thank you.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which will return on Sunday, April 22nd, when Victoria's guest will be An Chi Minh, author of Becoming Madame Mao, Wild Ginger, and Empress Orchid. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. Host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Today's broadcast was made possible in part by Maven Chronicles and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456.